Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I am delighted to talk to Imam Tom Fokini. You are most welcome, sir.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, Tom, for those who don't know, has kindly agreed to discuss the books that have made a significant difference to him intellectually. Now, apart from the intrinsic interest in what he might have to say, it will hopefully encourage us all to read good books for ourselves. Now, Tom accepted Islam in his early 20s, and he holds a BA in political science from Vassar College and a BA in Islamic law from the Islamic University of Medina, no less, graduating in 2020. He's also a qualified chaplain. Tom is currently the imam and program director of Utica Masjid. Now, Utica is in New York State, in America, obviously, as well as the imam of Hamilton College, where he does chaplaincy work. He also teaches tafsir to middle schoolers online through Legacy International Online High School. And he has a fantastic YouTube channel entitled Utica Masjid, which I stumbled across by chance, if there's such a thing by as chance, and I will link to it in the description below. And it is a gem. Anyway, I won't praise you too much, but I definitely encourage people to subscribe to. I don't normally encourage people to subscribe to things when I do these kind of interviews, but I do on this occasion in an unqualified way. Do subscribe to Tom Imam Tom's channel and for excellent content, because it really is superb. So Tom, over to you. What might be some of your favorite books?
Well, I guess I should start, if I'm going to start chronologically, then it kind of traces my, it's an inseparable account of how I came to Islam, because I kind of came into college as very much on the left, very much kind of progressive politics, leaning towards even some sort of anarchism, Marxism, sorts of things like that. Those are my commitments when I got to college. And then the interesting kind of path that I took was one of kind of a destabilization of the things that I had intellectually committed myself to, and at the same time encountering Islam for the first time in a serious way. So the first kind of book that had kind of a profound impact on me was actually The Order of Things by Foucault. So I, you know, Foucault is a controversial figure, and rightly so, and there's lots to critique. But there's also a lot of useful kind of perspective that he has.
Just to clarify, Foucault, not for your benefit so much, but Foucault obviously is a very famous French intellectual associated with Marxism to some extent, and certain very fashionable French ideas, which have influenced the whole world, the whole Western world, the United States, and latterly Britain as well. He's now passed away, of course, but I think he was very prominent in the 1980s and the 1990s, perhaps. But yeah, sorry.
No, well, thank you for that. And so, yeah, the main thing that the order of things awakened me to was his concept of episteme, right? So this kind of idea that there's a background grammar of associations, of values, of understandings that are kind of unspoken in any particular culture, or more accurately, an era, right? And so we really risk kind of falling into anachronisms, right? If we're going to look into the past, or we're going to look into a tradition such as Islam, and we might.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand. And even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Look at it with certain lenses. People want to know about feminism in Islam, or about freedom in Islam, or democracy in Islam. And people don't realize when they ask these sorts of questions that it's quite anachronistic, because we're talking about either concepts or categories that developed not only in a different location, but also in a different time, with different assumptions about who is a human being, or what is the reality that we live in at all. And so that was kind of the first thing that awakened me to kind of think about these things. It kind of particularized, I should say, to use that kind of jargon, yes, the commitments that I had at the time. And that's kind of, I guess, one of the main takeaways that I got from Foucault, is that there's sort of academic disciplines that originated in the West, anthropology, political science, econ, et cetera, that for a long time, they engaged in producing knowledge about a certain quote unquote other, the Muslim, or the, you know, the foreigner, or the non-European subject. And Foucault kind of flipped the lens, where he kind of took some certain academic disciplines and subjected Europe and European institutions and European thought to those same tools. And so now, instead of becoming the just assumed background through which everything is thought, now we can have a conversation about the particularity of certain ideas and certain categories and certain concepts. Mm. So that was the main thing that kind of, I guess, destabilized me.
I like that, destabilized. It shook you up intellectually and made you realize the particularity or the relativity of the views which we take as common sense and just part of the air we breathe. Actually, they're very regional, historically limited, and the result of a long historical process that we can look back to, you know, back to the Enlightenment and Renaissance and ancient Greece. Is all, you know, but it's very situated in a certain part of the globe that has become perhaps hegemonic now for other reasons. But I like what you say. So that was kind of your becoming self-aware of the historical contingency, I should say, the contingency, yeah, of our beliefs. And they're not just natural, although they feel very kind of just, you know, it's a part of the air we breathe. Actually, they're very particular, and it was sort of a long historical process that led to this, where we are today.
Yes, very much so. And so, you know, as I said, I came into college with this sort of very much solid leftist, even internationalist sort of position. And so that started to come into question. I started to attempt to account for my own beliefs and commitments And then throughout my coursework, I actually started as a history major, but I didn't find history as interesting as political science. So I switched and eventually went to political theory specifically. And my advisor was an Indian national, and he was all about post-colonial theory. And so we were heavily reading that sort of stuff. So I came across that. The next big book, I guess, and thinker that kind of took hold of me was Talal al-Asad. Right, and particularly the book, you know, Formations of the Secular, and this is something that has affected many, many people. So he takes kind of the technique of Foucault, but he has more particular interests. And one of those interests was secularism, okay, which was very, very interesting to me, because we, in the common culture, like the vernacular of people, we talk about secularism and religion in a certain way. We, especially in America here, separation of church and state, like this is a big thing. Everybody, don't talk religion and politics, you know, all these sorts of things that everybody always says. I always only wanted to talk about religion and politics, by the way.
It's ironic, by the rest of the world, we see the, you know, millions and millions of evangelical Christians who are passionately Zionist, who are influencing American foreign policy and electing people, which has geopolitical conflict. I mean, you couldn't get a more intrinsically, inextricably bound up political religious system, even though it's officially the opposite. It's absolutely a separation. The rest of us, it looks very ironic that rhetoric is still believed to be kind of true in any way. But
certainly. And so kind of the surface level point is where some people have noticed is that, okay, well, this is hypocritical. There is religion in politics. There is religion. Yeah. But the underlying point is that the relationship between secularism or what we want to say, the secular state and religion is not one of separation. It's actually one of active production, right? So the idea that there could be such a thing as a secular state by default requires the production of a certain definition of religion, even the category of religion itself, right? Like this word we have, religion. Okay. And that was one of the big things that, you know, blew my mind about Esed, is that, you know, this people weren't calling it religion up until very recently. They were calling it truth and falsehood, right? Or they were calling it orthodoxy and heterodoxy, or they were thinking through these things in other categories. And so there is no such thing as religion without the secular. Right, like the secular is directly involved in producing something. Maybe we call it acceptable faith or acceptable religiosity. It becomes the judge. Yes. It becomes the arbiter. This happens all the time in our country in the Supreme Court, and they have to, because people are going to appeal for certain exemptions or something on grounds of their religious faith. Well, which religious faiths are considered legitimate? Which religious commitments and beliefs are considered normative, which are considered reasonable. These are all things that this quote unquote secular state has to adjudicate all the time, right? So it is not just a mere issue of separation and distance. It is one in which actually the secular produces a certain type of acceptable religiosity, one that might prioritize or emphasize or encourage a privatization of faith or a certain entrance of religion and politics. Like you say, if we're talking about the entrance of evangelical politics into our relationship with Israel, then okay, that's okay.
Okay. It's almost, I mean, I'm an outsider, so forgive me if I'm wrong. Yes. It almost is obligatory. It's not like it's permitted. It's compulsory in the public domain, in the media and so on. One must almost perform the endorsement and the encouragement of certain positions on a certain subject, shall we say, to be at all a part of the mainstream, even to be acceptable in public discourse. It's that compulsory.
Yes. And one term that makes its rounds that kind of captures that sentiment very well, I think, is the whole idea of a Judeo-Christian tradition, right? This kind of myth that's been established as somehow Christianity and Judaism have something more in common. And that kind of leaves the third wheel as Islam, you know, out on the outside looking in. It kind of tips its hat or acknowledges this sort of mandatory entrance of religion, a certain type of religion into secular politics. Whereas others, if we're to take the logic and apply it evenly across the board, it would be completely rejected. If we're going to draw sort of, let's imagine the affinities, the geographical affinities that Muslims have across the world. when Iraq was invaded, or when Afghanistan was invaded, or these other sorts of things. Yeah, they're not only considered, to further your point, they're not only considered illegitimate, they are by definition a pariah, right, to the state. They are a security risk. They have to be neutralized, they have to be policed, and they have to be, certain actors need to be thrown in jail. You have the Holy Land Foundation, right, that was raising money for Gaza or the West Bank, and they were thrown in jail on the subject of a big criminal investigation, supposedly because, based on some suspicion that the money that they were raising was going to Hamas in Gaza. So it's very, very politicized. It's nothing but politicized. And sort of what religiosity is able to enter into the supposedly neutral public sphere is actually very particularly defined.
Yes, yes. No, indeed. Yes, yeah.
So that was kind of what spurred me onto this path of thinking about, yes, religiosity. And it honestly, it kind of brought me back to religiosity, because at that point in my life, I didn't think very highly of religion. But when I saw, and part of my other studies, and there's not one particular book I can point to, but it's the sort of typical post-colonial canon of Fanon and Homi Bhabha and Spivak and these people that, you know, we were reading as part of the coursework, allowed me to see that the civilization mission of European colonization had never stopped.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
That it simply only changed forms, or it had different waves, right? Yeah. So you could identify perhaps the first wave as the conversion impetus, right? And then perhaps the second wave was the resource extraction. And then the third wave perhaps was the secular civilization mission, right? We have, when we get to the 1800s, especially from the mid-1800s on, most of the colonial encounters, it's not about converting people to a certain religion. It's about trying to civilize.
Yeah.
Civilize the brute, civilize the barbarian.
Right? And this language you're using is not you retrospectively characterizing it such. That is the language that was used.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, because civilizing Muslims
who needed
to be civilized. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And this was seen as the prime directive of the West. It was to civilize the world. And you're saying that this whole kind of prime directive has changed form, but the fundamental imperative is still active today. Yet to say how, but I think you have a good point.
Yes, and the final way we could say that we're still writing is the whole human rights regime. Okay, so we're talking about the institutions such as the UN and the IMF and the World Bank, and how a lot of times financial resources and financial flexibility is tied to certain ideas of what human rights should look like, what women's rights should look like. Sabah Mahmood collaborated with some other thinkers on a very powerful article around the time of the invasion of Afghanistan about the discourse that was used before the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, and how the war was justified on humanitarian grounds about liberating the Afghani women. And this is a trope that goes back a long time.
Yes.
But this is the sort of thing. It's another wave of colonialism. Saving, especially saving the Muslim, supposedly oppressed Muslim woman from the barbaric Muslim man. Yeah. But there's other sorts of things. It could be gay rights. It could be women's rights. It could
happened,
be
happened recently, literally in the last week or so. I think the American embassy in Kuwait had the temerity to hoist the LGBT rainbow flag thing, much to the and the Kuwaiti government or whatever protested, ambassador protested, why are you flag? You know, this is absolutely contrary to our values and our faith. But the arrogance that that the country should do that is part of this civilizing mission, so that Muslims now will change their religion and see things as secular liberal Westerners do when it comes to a whole raft of issues to do with gender role, sexuality, you name it. So the prime directive, I'm calling it, continues and but it's just as aggressive because it's now in your face and it's not negotiable. You've got to accept this agenda. And this agenda, by the way, is always changing. I mean, it's very different from what it was 5 years ago. Yes. And doubtless it's very different from what it would be in 5-10 years. Who knows what then it would be? Maybe the rights of people to commit incest or I could speculate about bestiality or who knows what things which are unthinkable and taboo now. But these things we accept today were unthinkable and taboo 5 minutes ago. So who knows what the next prime directive will require Muslims to embrace from the West and the whole world, not just Muslims, by the way, Catholics, traditional Catholics, traditional Jews, even traditional atheists will also be required to submit to this prime directive.
Very much so. And it's very much by hook and by crook. I mean, like there's incentives and then there's interference, there's destabilization, right? And this is a point that we'll get to later when we talk about halak, the idea of exceptionality, right? Or the idea that, you know, the world can run on democracy until it steps out of bounds and then it needs an intervention, right? So for example, one of the prime examples is Gaza, when they elected Hamas as their democratically elected government. I believe that was 2006. That couldn't happen, right? That was the wrong choice. And so which value is going to win out? Is it going to be the process value of people and self-determination and these freedom and all these sorts of things that we hear liberalism justified upon the grounds of? Or is it going to be, well, who's really amenable to neoliberal capitalism and to our conception of women's rights or our conception of the human being, right? It's kind of like, it's clear which one takes priority. And
yeah, but I don't think it's just that. I think historically we looked at Chile in the what's called the other 9/11, as it's called, because September the 11th, I think it was 1977 or something, the 1970s, when the democratically elected government of Chile, headed by Allende, was his name, was actually overthrown by the Americans. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is a recognized documented fact. And then before that, in 1953, I think there was a democratically elected government in Iran. This is before the Ayatollah Khomeini and the current regime. And the democratic government that was actively overthrown, not just by the CIA, but by our guys, MI6. Even the BBC had a role. If you Google this, there's actually a whole Wikipedia page. I find it fascinating how the BBC played a role. This is the British Broadcasting Authority Corporation here in the UK, actually had a very interesting role in the timing of the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Iran. You wouldn't believe it. But the reason was, Oil. So the West has a very long history of overthrowing democratically elected governments when they don't conform to the policy agenda or expectations of Washington and London, usually. So it's not really to do with democracy, but the democracy is not the highest good at the end of the day. It's what's in the West's interests, whether it be geopolitics or oil or whatever. Anyway. Right.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye. your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yeah, they have many tools in the toolbox, right? So regime change is one of those one of those tools. Financial destabilization is another one of those tools. Interfering in elections in the first place, you know, is one of those tools. All sorts of things that they have. And yeah, so it's very much, we're still living in the state of colonial opposition. And the irony is that you'll have folks, especially liberals in North America and the quote unquote West, who are wringing their hands about the legacy, the colonial legacy of yesteryear. And yet they're on the front lines of today's colonialism. They're on the front line.
A very nice point there, Tom. Very nice point. Yes. They're kind of disowning the past colonialism, but that actually through the back door, they're promoting a new kind of colonialism whilst pretending not to be promoting colonialism at all. Very interesting.
And there's a, you know, getting back to Esed. So one of his footnotes, I'll never forget one thing that stuck with me. He shows how this sort of, he uses one historical example to show how there's sort of this, this is a legacy of, again, I guess this goes back to the difference or the disconnect between the legitimizing discourse and the reality. So we're talking about how does the world justify these sorts of interventions for freedom and democracy, et cetera, but really there's something else going on. So Esed, you know, cites in one of his footnotes when the European colonial powers at the end of World War I are about to carve up Turkey or the Ottoman Empire. They don't get to do it as much as they wanted to for reasons, obviously, but they have the plan. They have the maps all drawn out and they have the their kind of speech prepared, their justification. And the British had included the reason for crimes against Christendom. Okay, so it said crimes against Christendom, and that the whole Armenian situation, et cetera, et cetera. But France objected to that language because France had territory, you know, vast territories in which they had lots of Muslims, West Africa, and they said, no, we can't use that language. We have to use something else. So the language that they settled upon was crimes against humanity. And that was the first instance of the use of this phrase, according to Esed, of these crimes against humanity. So we see how we have this assumed Christian subject who the powers that be, we want to call it Europe, we want to call it the West, whatever we want to call it, have realized that they need to cloak that actual subject with a more universal language, right? We can't get around just slaying people and saving the Christians and, you know, fighting the infidels anymore. We have to at least give lip service to the fact that this is for all humanity. And people believe in that actually to various degrees or not. But this sort of discord is something that has always kind of stuck with me. So to get back to kind of, I guess, the broader sort of trajectory I was on. So Esed really awoken in me the idea of the religious as sort of a sphere or something to redirect my attention back to, or perhaps rethink, because he's saying that, okay, part and parcel of this new colonialism, or at least the implication, he's not super confrontational with his language, but inferred in his work is that one of the arenas of this new colonialism is also the secular, right? The replacement of the religious subject, or what we used to be called a subject, maybe a moral subject, a spiritual subject, a theological subject, an orthodox subject, with a secular citizen. Right? And that's where he places the difference of secularism and the kind of the, what makes secularism special is that he calls it a transcendent identity. So it actually displaces how we think about ourselves. Before the idea of a secular and a religious, how did people conceive of themselves? They conceive of themselves primarily as maybe human, primarily as perhaps souls, primarily as Muslims, primarily as Christians, you know. The logic of secularism requires a transcendent identity that is the citizen, in which now the religious identity is tucked as a minor identity marker, you know, just like alongside your ethnicity and your gender and your whatever else you have. So that goes back to kind of Foucault and the idea of the order of things. How are you arranging things? What are the categories through which you're thinking? If you're thinking through the secular, then religion can only be something that is private, something that is we could say a secondary or a tertiary sort of identity marker.
And what strikes me very much is that classically, Catholicism, the world's largest religion, would have agreed very much with Islam in identifying the human being as a servant of God or a child of God in a theological and metaphysical universe. So there was no secular realm. There was Christendom, of course, this great concept of Christendom, which is arguably parallel with the idea of say, like the Ottoman Empire. But that is gone now. And since the Second Vatican Council, at least in the Catholic Church, now they seem to have largely, it could be mistaken, but my impression is largely accepted the secular agenda. So they accepted secular democracy, the language of human rights and so on, and the private role of religion now, which wasn't the case before in faith. And then with Jews as well today, who appear to me wrongly perhaps as largely secular, but historically with Israel, of course, the state, I mean, the biblical, the Israelites in Israel, I should say, in the Jewish Bible was anything but a secular state. You know, you had God ruling through his prophets, through his kings, occasionally directly. So it seems to me, and maybe this is the attraction where you're going to, that Islam is the only Abrahamic faith or global faith left standing that is largely uncontaminated by the winds of secularism, which have basically humanize or secularize other faiths, and Islam is left standing alone to face inverted commas modernity. I say inverted commas because it's not just modern, it's Western, it's secular, it's liberal, and has a very particular historical origin, a particular expression, and it's evolving and changing all the time as well. So anyway, that would be my segue.
Yeah, that's fantastic, and that's exactly sort of the realization I had that got me interested in Islam in the first place. Right. That's exactly what I came to feel in my first undergrad, that Islam was the last thing left.
Yes.
And I hadn't even done the research that I had done, you know, since then about even how far Eastern faiths such as Buddhism and such as Hinduism and such as other Taoism and other traditions have kind of been subjected to this secularizing and reforming process in really, really interesting ways. I wish there was actually more awareness about that, maybe for a future project. But Islam really is kind of the last pre-modern, in the sense that you spoke, the definition of modern, faith system that's left standing. Even source of culture or source of sentiment, or even we can say in Foucault's terms, episteme. It's the last resistant episteme where you can actually have an entirely different worldview. Because the diversity that's being kind of championed today is the thinnest and most superficial type of diversity we have. We would like to have all different skin colors and all different clothes and all different whatever, maybe foods, but everybody believes the same thing.
Yes, yeah, so different sexualities, but we're all, as you say, we're within this same concept, this same paradigm, which is bounded by secular liberalism. Because within this, you're not going to traditional believers, be they Muslim, Catholic or Jewish, have no home. The one thing you can't be, I should say, is traditional. So you can't believe in traditional values, the traditional reference to the transcendent, i.e. God. That is other. You know, as you're saying, within our own small little bubble, that's what's permissible only.
Yes, very much. So that was kind of the start of that whole inquiry, and that led me down the path that it led me. And I came to see how the secular was just as much a crucial part of the new colonialism as.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
It's the other sorts of aspects of human rights and this and that and the other. And so that was, you know, after time, that kind of, long story short, that's how I came to Islam. But with, that kind of wraps up, Esed, but then there's other sort of thinkers that are tied to him. There was, Sabah Mahmoud, who I read a bit of, who was an anthropologist. She passed away. But she had a book called Politics of Piety that was very nice. It was super interesting because her positionality coming to it, she was kind of like a secular Pakistani woman who was doing field work in Egypt about the mosque movement or about some sort of religious revivalism in Egypt. And through stepping outside of her own culture, she was able to see Islam in a completely different light.
Wow.
And not going to claim that, you know, she had this, you know, personal revelation and became like a super practicing. I don't know her personal life, but she at least, and you pick this up in the book, came to appreciate after she left her own cultural kind of context and cultural rivalries about secularism in Pakistan versus, you know, religious, whatever in Pakistan. What she was able to observe in Egypt was something entirely different. And she actually wrote very profoundly about the mosque movement and about sort of religious revivalism and the sorts of concerns. Sorts of concerns that have been very central to me since I embarked on this path, which is exactly that. So one of my chief concerns as just a thinking person and someone who has kind of the training or experience as I do is drawing the line between that kind of secularized or secular produced religion and our authentic pre-modern, pre-secular religious tradition. Because the danger, and this is, you know, obvious to you, is that the danger is that we think maybe we're presented with a form of Islam or presented with a form of religiosity that we believe to be the authentic pre-modern continuous tradition that is Islam. And in reality, it's the secular reformed production that is very amenable to the secular nation state. And then we forget. And then what, right? That's like the worst thing. And what makes it tricky is that everybody knows in Islam, if you're a Muslim, you know that you have to appeal to Quran and Sunnah. Every single movement has to appeal to Quran and Sunnah. No one's going to take you seriously unless you say that your beliefs are based on Quran and Sunnah. But that doesn't mean that the things that you're advocating for are necessarily part of that continuous tradition. Maybe it may be that there's something that's new that's been introduced into how you're interacting or interpreting or even applying this tradition that is actually part of this colonial heritage and not something that goes back further than that. So that's always interested me, trying to delineate those sorts of things.
I think it's made it a lot harder. And this happens both in the United States and in Britain too, is the political alliance between Muslim activists and intellectuals and politicians and the left, the political left, which seems to be the default position. So, this comes at a huge price tag. Yes, the left may come to our aid to protect us and speak for Muslims if they're attacked or oppressed. And that's all very nice, very good, of course. But I would think it comes at a huge price tag. And for many Muslim, obviously not going to mention any names, of course, but for many Muslims, it appears to me that they become very quiet or very silent on those issues which the left do champion now very, very loudly and aggressively, which, of course, are antithetical to the Muslim position. So there's kind of, you get this kind of truncated Islam presented in effect to the public, because it's not the full, it's not the holistic system where there's ethics and the politics and there's teachings on sexual morality and so on. It's a kind of
truncated version, which kind of fits in with the left's alliance, the alliance with the left. And that's really sad because for obvious reasons, for those reasons, but also because I think, and I know it's a bit different in America, but there is much on the traditional right, as it's called it in Britain, the conservative right, which is very similar and overlaps with Islamic teaching. For example, the socially conservative views about marriage and roles, gender roles, and so on. And for various reasons, which I understand in America, there have been quite violent attacks from the right on Muslims, but at least there are conservative thinkers like Sir Roger Scruton, the British philosopher, who did in his later years, he died recently, have very positive engagements and conversations with Hamza Yousaf, for example, at Zaytuna, where there seemed to be a considerable convergence between traditional conservative philosophy and politics and Islamic discourse. And I found that very refreshing, rather than the usual kind of left-wing militant political discourse and the Muslim involvement in that as almost a sine qua non of any involvement in public life, an indispensable condition of public life.
Yeah, very much so. Someone put it, and I thought it was very succinct. They said that the right wants to kill Muslims and the left wants to kill Islam.
Yeah. And yes.
That's fairly accurate. And yeah, 100% what you said, we need to be aware of the categories through which we're thinking about our religion. You know, if somebody is, you know, you take all of the categories that are meaningful to the left, justice, you know, individual autonomy, all these sorts of things. If those are your sacred categories, right? Yes. And you can come to the tradition, you can come to the Quran and the Sunnah, those are your blinders. Those are the lens that you're looking through. You're going to curate the tradition and only choose that which adheres to this regime of kind of values and principles. And everything that violates it, you're either going to not notice in the first place, or you're going to explain it away in some sort of sense. And you've predicted, that's the danger, that you've then produced a new Islam that is not actually Islam, but maybe you do actually believe that it's Islam.
Yes.
As opposed to, you know, trying to reclaim what are the actual, we could say, indigenous categories through which we think of things as Muslims.
That's right. Funny. Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah. So the next book, or I guess the final book, and this is one that I haven't even finished yet, but that's engrossing me, and we talked a little bit about it, is Halaq wa al-Halaq.
Oh yes.
Particularly restating Orientalism. So Orientalism, I read a lot of Sa'id as part of my first undergrad, and I didn't get around to reading Halaq until actually fairly recently. Mm. And Halaq seems to me like to have taken this kind of trajectory of Esed and taken it even further. Mm. And he has a lot more familiarity and expertise when it comes to the Islamic tradition than I think Esed had. Sometimes I read Esed and I feel like he really pulled his punches. Like, you know, he has in the meat of his book so much there that's ready to critique and subvert and undermine sort of the things that are going on. And then kind of his recommendations at the end are like very, very like polite. Whereas I feel like Halaq is much more kind of straightforward and much more not confrontational, but direct when it comes to his criticisms of kind of this modern episteme.
Can we just clarify for people who don't know who Halaq is? Halaq happens to be a professor at Columbia University in the United States. He is a Christian, and he's born in a place called Nazareth, which I think someone else rather famous was born there once. I forget who. No, he was born in Nazareth, seriously. He's a Christian, and he features, I kid you not, in the top 500 leading Muslim thinkers or leaders in the world. If you look at the top 500 list put out by Muslims, he's in it. He's not even a Muslim. So he's like an honorary Muslim because he understands Islam very well, it seems, particularly Sharia, Islamic law. He has he's an expert. He teaches Islamic law at Columbia University, amongst many other things, philosophy and history and politics, political theory. And he is the latest hot thing to go. I mean, I'm reading The Impossible State by him at the moment. Like yourself, I've only encountered his work recently, much belatedly. So, and this is an award-winning book, very significant product, just written some years ago. And he's written another book or two since then. But no, he is hot property
intellectual hot property, and he is a must-read author, I understand, and I'm certainly benefiting from him in the moment. So back to you.
Yeah, I'm completely engrossed. You know, there comes along some of those books where you stay up at night trying to finish them or trying to finish the chapter, and it's definitely one. What I like particularly about Restating Orientalism is that he takes because people have a lot of critiques and people are very suspicious, you know, for example, because I've kind of been influenced by Foucault and that sort of critical theory sort of milieu. A lot of people, they have very little respect for that sort of milieu, and rightly so, because of where the culture has gone, right? Like a lot of kind of, at least in North America, the way that certain ideas or certain strains within postmodern theory and within, you know, critical theory have made it into the mainstream in a very problematic way. Mm. And so some people look very, you know, askance at me, you read Foucault and these sorts of guys. But those are oversimplifications, right? There's definitely a lot to glean. And I think Halak shows the power or the potential power of kind of those methods when they're applied in the right way, because he's looking at this modern episteme that we're in, and he's taking, especially in Restating Orientalism, because his point of departure for the book is to kind of critique Sa'id in his yes. books, Orientalism and yes. and Culture and Imperialism, which were yes. required reading for us when we were,
Just in case readers don't know, Edward Said, what was like the precursor in some ways, if that makes sense, of Halak. He also was a Palestinian, although I don't think he was born in Nazareth. Maybe he was born in Bethlehem, I don't know, but he was born in Palestine and ended up in America and being a professor as well. So they end up in the same kind of trajectory. But his magnum opus, his great work is Orientalism. It's called Orientalism. And this was like required reading. I think it probably still is required reading on university courses when it comes to, but I'll show you here. Show you how. So this is the book Orientalism with a rather dodgy cover. It's a highly acclaimed work. And he sadly passed away a couple of years ago. But oh, he was a professor at Columbia University as well. I've just realized. I wonder if he was the predecessor.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. Having fun in the sun or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
You've worked hard for what you have. Your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly 1 in 4 consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Anyway, this is the book you're referring to. It's called Restating Oriental, A Critique of Modern Knowledge by Halak. There we go, which I've not read yet. It's on my reading list to read. Next, and it is hot property. This is what one should be reading at the moment. If one wants to be seriously engaged in the current debates about political theory and critiquing Western epistemology, this effortless assumption that the way we see the world in the West is the natural normative way, that the universal prism through which we see reality. And in fact, it's not really like that at all. It's very particular and has particular agendas. And when it comes to Muslims, it can be very toxic. Anyway, I don't anticipate that.
And, you know, I think that a kind of a latent benefit of the book is that it delineates kind of the useful parts about critical theory from the more, I think, harmful parts, because he really blasts Said, to be honest, when it comes to his theoretical sloppiness and yeah. his lack of rigor. And he pulls quotes and he's referencing very, very specific things about basically the climate that Said had basically taken critical theory and turned it into the cultural phenomenon it is today, where it's just basically identity politics, where it's like, if you're not from X place, you can't speak about X, right? If you are not Arab, you can't speak about Arabs if you're not, right? That was his idea. His conception of Orientalism was simply misrepresentation.
Right? Yes.
And so, which is very, very thin compared to what Halak like goes to. Absolutely. Basically. Halak actually compares himself to, he says that I hijacked Said's ship and I rebuilt it and I took it to a completely different destination. So his project in the book is to kind of take the parts of Said's kind of either sensibility or whatever theoretical value he had, but then to really put some meat on the bones and to make it rigorous and to make it theoretically robust. Yeah. And what he ends up producing is absolutely amazing. Whereas we see the Orientalism of Said is the one that has drifted into mainstream culture. Yes. Where, you know, and the left and the what we associate with postmodernism and whatever Marxist culture, whatever we want to call it. But Halak has a completely different take entirely.
He critiques Foucault as well. Foucault appears in The Impossible State anyway that I've read. He actively engages with the very influential philosophers and political theorists from the West, often from France for some reason, who kind of form the epistemological background that we live and breathe through today, and we don't realize it. So that, and part of Halak's brilliance is to kind of deconstruct this and show that this is where this comes from. It's not kind of just a natural phenomena.
Yes, very much so. And one of his major, I guess, points in the book is, okay, we use this word modern all the time, but it's actually quite a slippery concept. It's certainly not a coherent one. Where do we draw the line? What is the beginning of the modern? Is modern simply having technology, gadgetry, industrial revolution? Is it the Enlightenment? Is it the episteme? What is it really? And Halak, I think, you know, he has a more narrow definition of what modernity is than some other thinkers who try to even expand it back to the Renaissance even, or just after the Renaissance. So Halak is talking about modernity as basically the point at which the state became sovereign.
Right. Yes.
Okay, so whereas, and someone's like, and we do this all the time, even again, talking about anachronisms, when we talk about the Muslim state of Medina, right? Halak would probably bristle at that.
He'd have a heart attack if you said that to him. Yeah.
Yes, he would. He would.
He'd fail you. If you were a student of his and you said that and you quoted that in an essay, you'd fail in his class.
Yes. You'd get a big red line. Yes, exactly.
You would.
His point is that the state is something entirely different. It's a technology of governance that is completely unprecedented in its reach and its ability to shape the interiority of subjects. Whereas before, there was always something external to governance to hold it to some type of accountability, even if there were individual situations where maybe there was a despot or a tyrant who superseded those bounds. But at least even the king that claimed to be a god, he had to adhere to what people's expectations were for what a god should be. And he risked losing legitimacy if he violated any of those sorts of expectations. The king, you know, before constitutionalism, there was still a sense of common law, or there was a sense of proprietariness or justness that had to be adhered to, that was above himself.
Yeah.
He didn't have absolute sovereignty in the sense that he couldn't do just exactly whatever he wanted to without any justification. He had to justify himself according to some regime of sensibility or some regime of ethics. Whereas what happens with the modern state is that the modern state has freed itself from needing to legitimize itself to basically anything. It doesn't admit that, right? If we look at the democratic state, we have all this pageantry about elections and things like that, social compact theory, and this kind of collective delusion that we accept the governing structures just by going to the polls every 4 years, right? Which is kind of a fantastic notion. But in reality, the state is completely sovereign, absolutely sovereign in an unprecedented way. It has
there's a fantastic quote here. I actually have it on my iPhone because I'm so impressed by Halak. If I may just read it. It's about secularism, but also to do with the state. He says, I forget which book this is from. I think it might be from The Impossible State. Let us remember what secularism is, writes Professor Halak. Secularism is not just segregating religious life into the private sphere. It is rather the determination of the state of what religion is and is not, where and how it can be exercised. In terms of political theology, I mean, political theology, that's a subject in itself. Secularism is the murder of God by the state. That sentence itself is so cool. In terms of political theology, secularism is the murder of God by the state. The state can delimit, limit, exclude, or curtail any religious practice, thinking here of France, for example, and thus has the power to determine the quality and quantity of the religious sphere as it sees fit. I mean, that's a great prose, but also it really gets to the heart of the matter in terms of this idea of political theology is something I'd love to see more revived, not just theology, which I'm very interested in, or just politics, but political theology, because the West has a very profound political theology, although it might not put it in those terms, in its secular view, where secularism is the murder of God by the state. The state is the new God, particularly in places like France, where the ultimate authority, the sovereignty now belongs to the state in a very absolute way. And lo and behold, if any Muslim possibly says Allahu Akbar, God is greater than, which is just the basic belief that God is sovereign. And that is political suicide in France. It's actually a blasphemy against the secular God to actually say God is greater than that. Anyway.
Yes, no, France is actually a very useful example for showing the type of secularism kind of taken to its final form, or maybe its logical conclusion, because, you know, there's a lot less, the mask has been ripped off, so to say, you know, all the pretense of toleration and the pretense of, rational discourse is completely gone. I mean, they simply are viciously kind of attacking and policing the interiority of people. And that's the kind of point of that halakha has, right? Because it's not simply how you conduct yourself in public. It's how do you feel interior, you know, to yourself? Is your allegiance to the state?
Yes.
Or is your allegiance to Allah or Islam? And we're going to find out if your allegiance is really to Islam or to Allah. Maybe it's the hijab, maybe it's Allahu Akbar, maybe you want to homeschool, maybe you have a beard, whatever the external signs are. What we're really concerned is your interiority. That's totalitarian in a way that no pre-modern governance structure could imagine.
And certainly no Islamic governance. If you look at the great Islamic, the Ottoman empires and so on, people were allowed to believe and have their own communities. They weren't required by the state to believe anything. On the contrary, Christians were allowed to drink wine and eat pork and have Christian beliefs. And so in an Islamic framework, under Islamic governance. In a sense, the Islamic experience historically, politically, was much more pluralist and diverse in a real sense, not just in the narrow way that you mentioned earlier, than modern Western democracies are. They're much less diverse and less pluralist. And when I say this to people in the West, they just don't believe. They say, what are you talking about? How can this be true? Until you actually explain it to them how it's true, how the Ottoman system worked for, I don't know, 700-800 years, you know, or back to Medina, the so-called constitution of Medina, where, Jews and Muslims and so on were each given their rights to practice freely their faith under the rulership, if you like, of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. So this is part of the DNA of Islam. It's not some kind of modern liberal idea.
Very much so, yeah. No, it's shocking once you remove kind of the smoke and mirrors and the mask off of things, how even the so-called virtues that the West attempts to attain to, whatever are legitimate virtues, Islam has completely outpaced them, both historically and textually, right? If we're going to talk about real tolerance, not just phony surface-level tolerance, then Islam far outpaces the West in the history of Europe and Christianity. And the same thing with pluralism and these sorts of things. It's very true. And so that's Halakha is sensitive to that throughout his writings. And that's one of the most beautiful things about reading his writing is that irony of all ironies is that, you know, yes, he's perhaps not a Muslim. I mean, Allah knows best, but he doesn't profess to be a Muslim. And so the way that he writes about Islam, it makes you feel that izzah, it makes you feel a certain pride in the pre-modern Islam and practice of the Sharia and of Islam. He has a really interesting discussion in Restating Orientalism about the differences between the LLC, right, the Limited Liability Corporation, and the Waqf. right? Two different technologies. And his point, and people make this mistake all the time, they engage in what I believe he calls the theology of history, which is to assume that technology just, you know, unfolds in some linear fashion, and it's just a matter of time until, you know, the nuclear weapons happen and this happens and that happens. And, you know, Halak does take kind of the method of Foucault and say, no, that the episteme is what's going to shape the contours of what you can even think.
Yes.
The episteme is going to shape the possibilities of what you can even do. Even the words that we have in the language for things, like the episteme is going to it's not like, you know, an extremely narrow path, but there are borders to it. It's not infinite. And so the episteme is going to determine what you can possibly think, say, and do. And so the point is not that Muslims did not have the technology, for example. They simply were behind the West and couldn't invent a nuclear warhead. It was that the episteme prevented such barbarity, right? The episteme that sought to the type of subject that the Sharia aims to produce, the moral subject, is incapable of imagining such a destructive and barbaric thing.
Yeah.
And so people put all this pride in sort of military technology and advancement, and really all that it's proven is that there are some people that are more ruthless than others, and have, you know, sicker imaginations and more barbaric imaginations than others. And then we come full circle, because who's the savage and who's the civilized?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely true. I was thinking about the recent technologies developed to, you know, the gender transitioning and all the sophisticated technology, you know, to actually, you know, this would be, it's not that Muslims couldn't develop, they would never develop that, because it would be unthinkable, because it would violate certain basic moral commitments to the nature of male and female and so on. But the West often it has not been inhibited by any moral code, it seems. It said, if science can do it, you go ahead and do it, see if you can invent this weapon of mass destruction, i.e. nuclear weapon, and use it. The only country in the world, I think, has ever used nuclear weapons on civilian populations is the United States of America, twice in Japan, and it destroyed Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And it's the only country that's ever done that in history, actually.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
They actually used weapons of mass destruction on a massive scale. Anyway, this is well known.
And refuses to apologize and refuses to take part in any sort of reparation for what it's done, and continues to live haunted by the guilty conscience, I think, that resulted from those sorts of actions, because American foreign policy is often animated by a level of paranoia that defies reason. Especially paranoia that other sort of states are going to obtain this sort of weaponry, or all these action movies have to do with, you know, the leaking of nuclear technology to these sort of bad guys. It's, who are the only people who have ever used that technology, right? It's kind of reminds me of Crusoe, and sort of this fantastic paranoia. So Halak, for example, he, and this is not to say, and we should clarify, because some people think in too stark of terms. So when they think about critiquing modernity, they're assuming that modernity is just, you know, technology and computers and cell phones and stuff like that. And so the question that always, you know, or the retort that people always give is, you don't want to have technology, you don't want to have this, and you don't want to have that. So no, the idea behind the episteme, or the difference in the episteme that we're drawing here, is that an Islamic modernity, if we're going to say that, if modernity is simply technological process, or excuse me, technological progress, then an Islamic modernity would have produced the goods that we enjoy without the bads, right? Like, certain things would have been impossible.
Yeah.
Right. We don't need to choose between, if we want internet, then we have to also have the nuclear warhead, right? That's not a foregone conclusion, right? We could have had the internet without the nuclear warhead. But we didn't. Why didn't we? Because we live under a certain episteme that separates, as Halak says, the separation between is and ought, which is what you just said. For example, when if we can do it, meaning if it's possible to physically be done, then it should be done.
Then we can, yes, exactly.
Whereas leaving aside all concerns as to, you know, what should we do? Like, what's the best thing? What's the most moral thing? And so he compares the technology. He goes back all the way to the Limited Liability Corporation and has some interesting sort of citations about the debate about that economic technology when it first arose and kind of the debate around how it was going to be potentially abusive. And he compares it to the Waqf system, which is kind of the opposite.
Could you explain what that system is for those who might not know?
Yeah, so the Waqf system is a system of, we could say, either a trust or an endowment. So it has to do with freezing an underlying asset, usually land or a building or something like that, and freezing it in the sense that it cannot be sold, it cannot be transferred, it cannot be given away as a gift, and it cannot be inherited. And it is the usufruct, which is the technical term for the revenue that it generates, is dedicated to a certain charitable cause. And Halaq goes into a lot of detail about the Waqf system and how central the Waqf system was to Islamic civilization for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that is completely in line with everything that I've ever read, even from, you know, classical Islamic sources that describe how there used to be certain endowments like this that were running hospitals, for example, and certain that were running schools, and others that were paving the roads or making roads, and others that were providing water to people on the street.
And education, supporting scholars, ulama as well. And this, of course, independent of the state. So these scholars were not employees of the state and all the connections and the ties and the liabilities that inevitably means. They were independent and they had their own revenue from, say, the land or the house or the building, whatever you mentioned.
Exactly. And that is the point that he's driving to specifically in restating Orientalism, where he eventually addresses education as its own thing and shows how independent, like what it's not to say that there was never any relationship or even attempted interference between, say, a regime or a political regime and a Waqf or their educational institutions, but there was no national curriculum and national standards and enforcement of these pronouns or that pronouns or this curriculum or that curriculum. It was very, very much more decentralized and independent. And so, you know, it avoided that sort of conflict of interest.
And I remember a friend of mine saying, I forget the exact date, but there was a time when the ulama, the Islamic scholars at Al-Azhar University, if not the most prestigious seat of learning in the Muslim world, were obviously scholars and independent. And there was a time in the 20th century, it might have been under Nasser, I forget when they became employees of the state. They became civil servants.
Yes.
Can you imagine? I mean, imagine the change that meant when the state actually employs you. Are you going to criticize the state? Are you then going to accept its directives, its programs, its encouragements, perhaps to maybe not say this and maybe look at that? You're not independent anymore. But it gave them job security because they were employed by the state, but at a huge cost. And so that, and I don't want to criticize institution directly because I know nothing about it, but it does seem that they are now civil servants, whereas before they were independent, and that surely that is significant.
Yes, and that's actually one of the beauties of specifically that book, is Halaq goes into a lot of detail and skips around the Muslim world to show the process, and it mostly happened across the 1800s, particularly the latter half of the 1800s. We're talking Algeria, we're talking Egypt, we're talking even the Ottoman Empire, India, Pakistan, Indonesia. The playbook was always the same. And it comes right back to that state sovereignty that he talks about. And what you just kind of illustrated is that in order for state sovereignty to be asserted, the first thing that they did when they came to Muslim lands was break up the Waqfs. They broke up the Waqf. They seized the property, their underlying assets. It could no longer function independently. It had to be subsumed within a department of this Department of Education, Department of Property. Though sometimes it was as crude as those underlying assets being put back on the market and returned to circulation. But sometimes they let them exist, but they, exactly like with Al-Azhar, they appropriated the usufruct, or they meddled with the, they salaried everybody and they brought them under the centralized control of the sovereign state. And so that was maybe even more significant. This is where Halaq would draw a distinction between sort of like pre-modern colonialism, which is kind of your Columbus and your these guys who are just going for conversion and stealing gold, and, you know, barbarism and things like that, versus once we get to the 18th, the 19th century, the 1800s, it's kind of a different flavor. That's where his definition of modernity really kicks off, where it's about the sovereign state. It's yes. about control. It's about controlling the internal subject, producing an entirely new subject. And this is where we get quotes from all the colonial administrators. You know, we want to kill the Indian and save the man. Or, you know, we want people who are Indian in their color and in their et cetera, but they're British in their mannerisms and their opinions and et cetera, et cetera. This type of thinking where we want to keep the thin superficial diversity, but the internal diversity, we want to crush it. We want to make sure that there is no subjectivity except for a subjectivity that is obedient to the secular state and its logic. And so that's where they reformed law codes. Halak goes into a lot of detail about reforming of the legal codes and compares the Sharia and all of its kind of, you know, its local sensitivities, its decentralized nature versus the kind of codification of law that became very rigid and inflexible and centralized. Again, from Morocco to Indonesia, like he skips across the Muslim world and shows how this is only possible within this sort of episteme that demands this sort of totalitarian control of the internal self. This did not exist. This is unprecedented. That's Halak's claim.
And I like that, unprecedented. And that's the point. I mean, he's very critical in the impossible state, by which he means the Islamic state in a conceived a modern state is impossible because of those reasons. Simply to Islamicize the modern state is a contradiction in terms. The Islamic governance has always been very different, been more decentralized. There's been these independent agencies like the ulama and so on. It's not this absolute state, this unprecedented phenomenon we see today, which he says is very un-Islamic. You can't just Islamize it. You have to have a different paradigm. Although I'm not sure he talks about the alternative paradigm in that book. But and this is a central question for Muslims, of course, in terms of the caliphate, which I think is a really important subject, different area, of course, of discourse from us now. But he makes some very profound points. And for a Christian to make these points for a Muslim audience who are appreciating what he's saying is also unprecedented, I think.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and I mean, we see the illustrations of those points now, right? You look at all the examples that we have of a state-sponsored Islam.
Yeah.
You know, have, without naming names, everybody knows, you know, the sort of when the state gets behind Islam, it's always with an agenda. It's impossible not to. And so they're in the process of curating that tradition to something that's amenable to their own interests. And then because it's the sovereignty of the state that's at stake, they're going to be very, very ready to declare anything and everything else as not Islam, as heresy, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's actually a very precarious thing. We can't have just an Islam that's simply sprinkled on top of the same forms and the same episteme that has produced the modern state. We really do need a paradigm shift, as it were.
And it just shows me really great ironies of our time in the West. If you really want to be radical, if you want to be a subversive, you want to be a revolutionary, don't become an anarchist. Don't become a Marxist, because a lot of your Marxist radical views are culturally dominant. They're in the media. They're fashionable. Corporations are shouting your slogans now. If you really want to be a radical rebel, you've got to be subversive. Be a Muslim.
Be a
traditionalist. I mean, there are traditional Catholics and others who occupy a similar kind of space in that kind of subversive area. But Muslims are by far the biggest and unsubverted religion in the world, though. And it's Muslims who are they're not a threat, that they are a potential hope for a different paradigm that could bring much more holistic healing and liberation for humanity. So it's not a dangerous threat, it's actually an alternative for hope, where secular models and discourses just don't offer any answers about what is the meaning to life. How do we live our lives? How do we relate to God? Is there an afterlife? What does it mean to be good? That this discourse has nothing really to give, no answers really. But religion does have answers. And Islam preeminently has the complete set of answers, arguably, to offer mankind. And that's the great hope, I think, of religion, where liberalism can't offer any answers, really.
Yes, no, that's I think, one of the most important things, especially to drive home to non-Muslims, is that look at the society that we're in. Everybody is sick. Everybody's sick. when it comes to the drug addiction and pornography and your media and everything, people are living miserable lives. And it's impressive the degree to which corporate mass media is able to convince people that they are living in the most free and happy time that has ever existed, the pinnacle of progress of Western civilization. We've got the best of the Greeks and the best of Christianity and the best of this and the best of that. And yet everybody's sick. We're killing the earth, you know, that we're destroying the environment. Nobody's happy, right? And there's this kind of cognitive dissonance that people have yet to admit. But I think if they admit it, then they need to start looking for alternatives and for redemption. That's the word that I like to use, that Islam has the redemption of the West or any place inside of it. And that, again, last hope. It's the last hope because the kind of... whether it's the secular state or whether it's kind of the corporate interests or neoliberal capitalism, has successfully managed to co-opt every other sort of movement and resistance, as you said. You know, and now you've got pride flags on warheads that get dropped on countries, right? That's just like a perfect metaphor for the trivialization of what people incorrectly assume is some sort of liberatory worldview or something like that.
I saw a recent prior, I won't mention what it is, but there was a US Army advert or military advert, I'm not sure the army or not, and it had a picture of a helmet and it had a picture of four bullets strapped to the helmet. And this is an official military US military advert, by the way. And they were all gay pride things, like gay bullets, basically. And the idea is you can go and fight and kill the enemy with some gay bullets in the name of that. I mean, It's unthinkable that this has been done 5 minutes ago, and now this is now official propaganda.
Yes.
LGBT bullets that will kill the enemy. I mean, right. Presumably Muslims or yes. Unbelievable.
And if that doesn't make people stop and think, I don't know what will, because people need to realize the ways in which they're being used, and even their good sensibilities of justice or their sympathies are being used and co-opted. Right, all of these things are part of the same cultural force, the same global monoculture that's kind of being shoved down our throats. And the only thing left to resist it is Islam. So, and if we sacrifice, as you were saying, that the sad thing is that if we sacrifice that Islam in order to fit in and curate our tradition and for the sake of political alliances, we're going to lose the exact thing that stands to redeem the place that we live in and everybody in it.
Amen to that. Amen to that. Well, I guess that's it. Well, thank you very much indeed, Imam Tom, for your prodigious reading and your time. And I'll itemize the books that you've mentioned in the description below, as well as put a link to your mosque and your YouTube channel, which is definitely worth following. You're very, very active on YouTube, producing some very good quality content on a daily, almost hourly basis. Sometimes I feel it's a great output there. Well, thank you very much, Imam Tom, for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Pleasure.
Take care. Until next time.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.